I do my show on the Heritage Radio Network because I think it's important to talk about the impact of technology on our lives.
I do my show to reach home cooks and help them do better.
Because I love getting together with people in the industry.
I like hosting my show because, to me, it's the stories about people and their relationship to food that help make the food more interesting and more delicious.
Our hosts do their shows as a labor of love, but we still need your financial support in order to keep the lights on and keep the tape rolling. Please become a member today at heritageradionetwork.org.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit korin.com.
I'm Damon Bolte, host of The Speakeasy. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host Akiko Katayama, a food writer and a director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deeper understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from a studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli and supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I'll try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And my guest today is Tama Matsuoka Wong, who is a Harvard Law School graduate and former lawyer, and now is a fundraiser for Top Chefs in New York City, and author, speaker, to advocate sourcing, rediscovering, and creating the best in white food, locally and sustainably harvested. Foraging is becoming increasingly popular lately in the U.S., and top chefs work with foragers to get the best ingredients from the nature to distinguish themselves. So we'll talk about Tama's dynamic career transformation and the importance of foraging and her fascinating clients and more. Hello, Tama. Welcome to Japan Eats.
Thanks for having me, Akiko.
So first of all, let's talk about what the commercial foraging is. What is the definition?
Well, I guess commercial foraging is when you're supplying something for money. You get paid to produce, to sell somebody some foraged item.
Mm-hmm. Right. But I think, you know, say 20 years ago, mm-hmm. you know, I heard some chefs told me, like, this guy showed up suddenly and he has a bunch of stuff. And I liked it, so I use it. So it doesn't sound like a continuous supply or something like, you know,
right. Well, I guess, you know, just the basic definition, the way I think about it is that, you know, foraging is something that's much broader than mm-hmm. just, you know, commercial foraging. So anyone can do foraging for themselves where they go and pick their own things in their backyard or whatever.
Right.
But it's a completely different process and activity to engage in as a business, you know, so to have business insurance, to be able to supply some reasonable consistency, et cetera, and to determine the price.
Right. That's a big part. Right. And so why do you think foraging is becoming so popular nowadays among top chefs in the U.S. and in other countries?
I mean, I guess for me, I think the main thing is flavor. I think that they're looking for new flavors and textures, and I think that wild foods have this in abundance.
Mm.
And in addition to that, of course, there's the whole trend from Noma, which is a restaurant that
in Denmark
that basically encouraged all chefs to know nature and to at least have experienced foraging if they want to put nature on the plate. But in addition to that, it's a combination of old and new. So some chefs are doing this because their heritage and their traditions from around the world did this always. So it's a combination of old and new, I would think.
Mm.
But most of all, flavor.
Right. So I think you're right. And then the Noma in Denmark, the chef René Redzepi, I think the reason this whole movement of Nordic cuisine became popular is it's kind of like the opposite of modern Spanish cuisine. It's I wouldn't say it's a negative term, but the manipulated, you know, dishes, like
right.
to push the envelopes. But this one, Nordic cuisine, it's more like go back to the tradition, what people have been eating traditionally, and then naturally go back to the nature, which is in common with the foraging. So, yeah, and then I think nowadays, the internet, everybody's connected, and then everybody's informed. You need to find something new. Right.
But I think it's even, from what I can understand, it's even more than just finding something new. It's almost that it's a knowledge as a chef that you are supposed to know. So in the past, would be like, you have to know how to make a Bernaise sauce, or, you know, anyone, like 101. So now it's at least you need to know the top 10 forged stuff or how to get them or what's a good, it needs to be part of your repertoire.
Right. I think maybe it's related to like farmers market booming because of local sustainable, so preserving the nature. Okay, so tell us about your background. So I heard you graduated from the Harvard Law School and worked as a corporate attorney.
Yes, so it's a very strange turn to what I'm doing. But actually, everything I did before helps me with what I do today. So I was in business world. It was very enjoyable. I spent about 15 years overseas. And
I think in Tokyo, New York, and Hong Kong for law practice.
Yes. Wow. Well, working actually inside a Wall Street firms.
Wow.
So it's also a managerial type position. So, but you see a lot of, you know, it's very dynamic. And so a lot of what I'm doing now, I feel, is the kind of pace and the change and the creativity and problem solving isn't really that different, amazingly.
Oh, that's interesting. Right. So depending on you, just dealing with the concrete and the office rooms versus nature. I don't know which is more manageable, but there are so many ways.
Well, but it's still this. The problems aren't that difficult. There's still people problems. There's situation problems. And you try and put together and come up with a structure that will allow you to succeed and attain your goals.
So what is the point of the transformation? Because, you know, it's completely 180 degrees.
So I guess the main point is that there really isn't like a point. Like, I didn't decide I was going to change this. It's just that I'm at a certain age in my life that I felt like I had done a lot of what I had wanted to do in sort of my professional career. And this just kind of happened and took over. And so why not go for it?
Right. A little bit like so that. What is that the moment? What moment made you change that?
It was just sort of organically. It wasn't like a one day I woke up kind of thing. I mean, a lot of it, I think, had to do with writing the book that I wrote, Forge Flavor. So in order to do that, I really couldn't work full-time in my other
job.
Wait,
but you were working in this corporate environment, like offices, and then you were foraging at the same time?
Oh, okay. So, yes, I was working in the corporate environment. And then, you know, I moved back to the United States from Hong Kong.
Okay.
And so when you've been... I was born here, but when you've been away for a long time, you look at it really differently. So when I came back, I just felt a connection again to, like, I appreciated much, much more, like the sky and how much, you know, natural resources there are here.
Well, it sounds like you never moved back to Manhattan, but where did
I didn't. So we moved back to, I moved to New Jersey in a rural environment.
Okay.
Partly because my youngest daughter had really bad allergies. And so I started to think that even though I'd lived around the world and been to all these places, I started to think the new things that were really in short demand and the new luxury is clean air and water.
Oh, okay.
So I wanted to live in a place that was like that.
Right. So you started foraging for your daughter too, for improving?
So I didn't start foraging for her. I mostly was started off from, I started off because I wasn't very good at gardening. I was like, I want to have a garden and, you know, maybe I can plant some kind of, you know, roses or tomatoes, and everything I planted died. So it was more that I started looking at, like, well, what's going there anyway? If I don't have time, you know, what is there? And the more I started to understand the plants that grow around us naturally, the more I started to appreciate them. And then there are a lot of people around me that started to explain to me that all plants aren't the same and how they relate to the landscape. So I started getting involved in it in that way.
Okay. Yeah. So in other words, you just gave out to control the whole garden.
Yes.
And then the thing started to grow. That's how it happened.
Right. So then I instead of giving up, I started to, you know, look at it positively. What can you, you know, what can you use these things for?
So people call it weeds. So you...
Yes.
You decided to grow weeds in a way.
So I actually wasn't thinking of it. Well, I was thinking the terminology that you usually use in the conservation community, which is who I was working with a lot, is native plants versus non-native plants. So native plants are indigenous, they're connected to the diversity of the land, the natural landscape, and there's a lot of plants that come in and they disrupt things. And they're either invasive plants or just, you know, regular old, you know, non-native plants. And so I didn't think of them as weeds until I started to realize that people looked at all of them as weeds. And that was something that people could understand if you said, what's a weed, as opposed to a native plant? Because it's just like people, everyone can say they've recognized a weed.
Interesting.
Or weeds.
Yeah. What is the, I don't want to say on the Japanese, but there is a really destructive Japanese weed. That's the, what's the root? There's like a crazy root.
What is it? A root?
Like the plants, but it's, the roots goes down and completely...
is it
take
the
over.
Knotweed?
Yeah.
Itadori?
Yeah, I think
okay.
so.
Yes.
Right.
So that was actually the first, I had some on my place.
Okay.
And that was the first one that I was kind of battling because all these people around me told me that you need to get rid of this because it's going to take over the roots. It'll keep spreading and spreading and take over your whole house. And so it was kind of depressing, actually, because you know, you're trying to get rid of something and every year it comes back more and more. And so actually how I first found out that it was edible was from these two Japanese professors who came to visit us. And they felt really bad, sorry, that we that this plant was causing all this trouble in New Jersey and other places in the world. But they said, you know, this is good to eat in Japan when it's young. So then I started to think, it's like something I could do. I don't, you know, I don't feel like all my efforts are for nothing. I don't have to feel depressed.
Right. So can you tell listeners again, what's the name of the plant?
Japanese knotweed.
Knotweed. Okay. Yes. That's knotweed. That's like knot. Right. So, okay. As far as it's young, it's edible and good for you.
Yes.
Right. Okay. And
and very popular now too.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So no more weed, they hated plants. As far as you educate people.
It's still somewhat hated, but at least you can use it for something.
Right. Okay. And so in 2009, you started working as a professional forager. I think officially you incorporated.
I would say that. Well, I say I incorporated, but I wouldn't say I was working as a professional forager.
Okay.
So I was really just working on this project where this is where I discovered that these things were edible, and I tried to look up these books about. Okay, so what can I do with this? And most of the books, the recipes in them were not really good for my family. Wouldn't like them. Like boil it three times to reduce bitterness or something. And even I found this Japanese foraging book that my cousin had bought me from Japan, and my father translated it for me. And all the recipes are exactly the same for every single plant. Or hitashi or tempura or something like that. So I was like looking for more stuff, more recipes. And so, you know, that's where I brought some food into a restaurant, Restaurant Danielle.
Oh, that's a Michelin two-star French
restaurant. And they started, the chef de cuisine there, Eddie LaRue, said he was really curious about all the stuff because that's just like what he's interested in.
Okay.
And so he asked me to start bringing him things, but it was just like the project. He actually at the time he said he would pay me something. And I said, no, I don't want, you know, I don't want you to pay me. I just want recipes because I was looking for recipes for my family.
Oh, okay. So you were just dining as a guest and then gave it to him and then...
Yeah, well, some friends took us there as guests. And then I met him later in the kitchen. And he wanted more things. I had, you know, by that time I was a plant geek. I had cataloged all the plants in my, excuse me, in my place. And had 225 plants.
225. Wow.
So I started bringing him. I said, what do you want me to bring? And he said, bring me everything. So we started this, we just called it the project. The project. And then he would come in early. And I would bring, like, everything edible. And then he would start saying, like, try it all these ways. And then he'd think... He was looking for the time, like everything has a season. So when is a time when it's the best time for culinary purposes?
Right.
So it's much more than just identifying a plant. It's like, how are you using it? Which parts? When is the peak? You know, for whatever use you're using for. And so that was the project. That's what I was doing in 2009.
Okay.
So I wouldn't say I was a commercial forager yet. You have to kind of learn the substance first.
Right. But just Eddie LaRue, that's really the top-notch chef. It's great beginning. Right. So, and where did you and do you forage?
Where, sorry?
You know, where do you pick your plants?
Well, so my Well, because also see my legal background, I have to do everything in the legal way. Mm-hmm. So I have my own properties, 28 acres.
Okay.
And then now I'm also leasing other properties. So I have my own property and then I also lease them.
Mm.
And then I also have certain arrangements with mostly conservation groups.
Okay.
And the main thing that I do with them is I take away plants they don't want. Like they're trying to get rid of them. And they don't have enough volunteers to do it. So then I try and work with them and report what's going on.
Okay. So it's a mutual.
It's mutual.
Right? Yes. Win-win situation. And then you can find new things by expanding.
Yes.
Right? The areas too. And then I think, you know, the plants want to be discovered too. So,
yes.
Right? It's like win-win-win situation. Right. Okay. And I think you just said before the show, we just had a chat and you told me you have organic certification at one of the properties.
Yes.
Amazing.
Yes. So that was a really, I mean, I wanted to do it because the property which I am actually leasing from a municipality, an open space, it's already been in organic, organically certified. So they wanted to continue that legacy and I wanted to continue it for them too. But it was really a good and educational process to go through to see how, you know, how I'm doing things and how does it relate to the U.S. government definitions, you know, of things. So that was really, it was really a worthwhile experience.
We can do
through.
A whole show about it, actually. The organic certification.
Very, and just like the definitions, like what we think is, you know, a vegetable and what they call is. So it was a good way to kind of understand their definitions and make sure that we were describing it in the way that they would understand.
Interesting. What's the difference? I'm curious.
Well, they do have a definition of wildcrafting, and it did not fit our definition. Mm. So then I had to say that I could not define what I was doing as wildcrafting, but I could call them crops.
Okay.
So I couldn't call them vegetables.
Mm.
I really like, what do I call our
right.
things?
So you know, basically,
really, so you just have to call it crops and then you list all these things.
Okay, as far as you have you participated in the certain process of growth, it's a crop.
Yes, right? It is. But it was very interesting to kind of go through the process and then there was an inspector that comes and they're actually very informed it really helps you to understand it really helped me understand the larger picture of how to do things correctly. Like you need a buffer. If you are that, then people know you're not just picking something along the side of the road. First of all, you have to control the land that you're foraging. So you can't just be going around. You have to either have ownership or a lease or something in writing.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just be like, okay, I'm just picking around wherever I find things.
Intrusion.
You know, so you have to have control, and that means that because you have a legal right to it, you also have the right to legally control all the inputs on that property, right? So that you know it hasn't been sprayed, and you know that it hasn't been contaminated with something because you have the legal right to that property.
Right.
So that's very different from just going around and someone says, "Oh yeah, it's okay," but do you really know that? Can you really control that?
Right. So you're responsible for the entire process from birth to death,
including the tools that you use.
Oh wow!
If any of the tools have been used for a non-organic, not certified crops, they have to be cleaned.
Wow. I'm glad it's so strict in a way.
Yeah.
Right.
But that just shows you how, you know, the whole process. And then you have to keep records of everything. And, you know, everything. So you have to be able to, you know, show it to the inspector and he looks at it and everything. So that it's a good way, I think, a discipline.
I'm glad you're a lawyer.
Yeah, so that's really helps. You've had to know all those things.
Right. And how many different kinds of plants do you have in the area?
Right. You mean that I'm selling?
Wait, okay. Right? Yep.
I would say 200.
Oh, wow. That's a lot.
Yeah. And every year there's something new.
Something
new. Yeah.
Right. And so seasonally rotates. So.
Oh, yeah. At any given time, maybe 15.
Wow. Okay.
So the difficult thing from a commercial point of view, I think, is logistics. Because unlike a farm where everything grows and, you know, you plant things and they all grow in these rows in this one area.
Mm-hmm.
If you're foraging, which is really chasing nature's season, these are free-range plants, right? They're growing where they want to grow, and they're going to grow in communities that are attuned to the kind of habitat that they need. So you have to chase them.
Right.
You know, I mean, there are certain things you can do on a small scale probably to increase it, but for the most part, the logistics is finding things from different places and then bringing it all together and delivering it.
And that make you healthy too. You have to chase your career.
Okay,
that's great. Right. And by the way, in 2007, you were named Steward of the Year by the New Jersey Forest Service. So what is it?
Oh, that was for my own property.
Okay.
And that's actually, again, not so different in some ways from the organic process in that you have to start with a plan. Mm-hmm. So here's this property. I've looked at it. This is my management plan. So you're actively engaged in managing your property. Mm. And so if you have certain trees, there are certain ways to increase the health of your forest. Mm-hmm. You have a plan to do that. You work with a forester.
Right.
And then mine plan at the time was somewhat unique because unlike a plan that would look at a single tree as a crop, right, that you then harvest. Mine was more based on diversifying the species in my place.
Right. So and you're creating, contributing to create a
more
kind
diversity.
Of like an ecosystem.
Yeah. So it was more about diversification and less about commoditization.
Mm, nice. Okay. And on your website, you say, our philosophy, we break down assumptions about what is ugly, what is useless, what is unwanted, and we gleaned unwanted weeds. We believe in the power of nature to heal, to feed, and to connect us with each other. So can you elaborate on this statement?
So I think that a lot of what I observe is that we have these preconceived notions in our head about this is good and this is bad.
Right.
And so we've decided we're trying to plant these things and control nature. Whereas I actually feel like working with nature and taking what nature naturally wants to grow there and managing it, but working with nature is actually more powerful.
Mm. Right, because there's a reason for a certain plant to grow, this right environment.
And I think, people use the word sustainable a lot, just thrown around a lot. I think that this is actually what is really meant by sustainable.
Mm. So do you have an example of what kind of plants would contribute to,
Okay. So one example, and I did a Kickstarter about this. So this was, I've gotten into this concept of wild farming, which people think like, wait, farming and wild, isn't that two different things? But it really shouldn't be. Mm. So I have a lot of demand for sumac. That's one of the top, there's an American sumac. It's very different in flavor profile. It's a different species from the sumac you see in stores most of the time.
Right.
So all my clients love it, and it's so much more superior in flavor to the European sumac.
Mm.
It's less vinegary, it's more subtle, has cherry notes, it's really nice. And the American Indians used to use it as a sumac aid, and it's very healthy, it has a large amount of antioxidants, vitamin C. But so when you're really looking for sumac, though, it's actually, people think it's like a weed, but it's not as easy because we've cut down all these hedgerows where it would normally grow.
Mm.
And so the only places you can see a lot of it sometimes now are on the side of the highway, which is not, again, a buffer. It's not a good buffer against contamination. Yes. So I actually saw this piece of land that is owned by a conservation group, and it's almost like a corridor that sits between a lawn, which is completely mowed grass, and a hayfield. So it's just like almost like a barren area, but it's between two adjoining forests. So if that you reconnect that forest, you're reconnecting a wildlife corridor.
Okay.
And the kind of plant that would normally naturally grow there is sumac.
Mm.
So I did this Kickstarter. I've planted this kind of sumac farm. And we're taking data because there's a lot of things that people don't know. And, it's a work in progress. But that would be an example of something, I think, that is restoring diversity.
Wow.
And at the same time, restoring the landscape plus providing an excellent product.
Mm, I want to taste that.
You should come.
I would love to. So what's the benefit of utilizing all those, the foraged items?
The benefit for?
Basically, we've been talking about unwanted weeds, right?
Yes.
And then by eating them, what is the benefit?
Well, I mean, on a small you know, for yourself, I think it's healthy in adding diversity to the foods that you eat. I mean, you know, a lot of what people are saying now is you need to eat more plants, plant-based diet, and diversity of them. So this is, you know, probably some of the most healthy foods you can get. There has been a lot of information written on that. So I think the benefit is first yourself.
Right.
And then secondly, if we are picking this in a, you know, sustainable fashion, which is distinguishing between the invasive plants versus the native plants, et cetera, and the way that we're harvesting them, then you're also benefiting the environment.
Because in a way you are stored.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
For the healthiest way, the land demands this plant, not this one. So you have to kind of correct it.
And there's really fewer inputs. So in the sumac farm has no irrigation, no tilling, no herbicides or pesticides.
Right.
So, you know, it's probably...
So in other words, if it's native, probably you could go naturally organic, that kind of idea.
Yes.
Right.
So, because if you think about a lot of agriculture, a lot of it's all based on plants that are not indigenous to this country.
Right. It's fascinating. Like, you know, if you go to Highline plants are all native. I haven't seen most of them.
Sumac is in there, actually.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, wow. So, my listeners, don't go hunt it.
Oh, yes. Nobody is allowed to pick from the Highline. It would not be.
Right. Okay. So, you know, it's interesting that you said, you know, it's more nutritious to eat those leaves because it's more different kinds of vitamins, minerals, and different kind of other
phytonutrients.
Sugar,
right. Yeah, there was a book that was written about this that I kind of like look at that book. It's called Eating on the Wild Side.
Okay.
And it was actually, she was interviewed extensively, and she did a whole study on studies that had been done on nutrition.
Right. Okay, so it's proven. And I watched your amazing TED Talk, TEDx Talk, called How Did I Less... How I Did Less and Ate Better, Thanks to Weeds. So I really enjoyed it. So maybe you can talk about what it's about for our listeners.
Well, I guess the reason, you know, that that TEDx Manhattan asked me to be on that is because the TEDx Manhattan was all about food. And then TED is supposed to be about ideas worth spreading. And so a lot of, I mean, I talked about my journey here and why I think it's, you know, I feel very passionately about this because it's more than just identifying and picking things because it's cool, even though it is fun. It's really impacts a lot of the challenges we have in our future, such as we mentioned, the health, environment, and our food. It impacts all those three things. And but at the same time, a lot of it's not that hard, you know, especially for yourself. It's not that hard because it just... how you can start is just changing the way you're thinking about things.
So it sounds like you're not just foraging for chefs, but working with something a lot bigger, like environmental activist kind
That's
of.
That's where I don't know if I consider myself an activist, but definitely a steward. And I started from that perspective before I met any chefs. I didn't even know I was supposed to call them chef.
Right. Right. So what kind of other activities do you write? I mean, we're going to talk about your book later, but do you talk other than TED Talk? Or what kind of?
Yes, I do lectures. I do, I actually have an agent who I'm on the Random House Speakers Bureau.
Great.
I am doing a series of workshops for the first time for the public. I don't normally do that most of the time because not that I don't love doing them, but I just don't have enough time in the week. But I have agreed to do a series of workshops we can talk about later, which I think will be, I'm very excited about.
Okay.
Because I think there's a joint thing between information and also execution, you know, actually getting the things available to people.
Right. Okay. Yeah. You know, like I said, the TED Talk, TEDx Talk was very fun. So I'm going to put the link on the show page. But if you can give me some other links, I'll put it
up. Okay.
Okay. Right. And so let's take a quick break here. And then when you come back, we'll talk about top chefs who use Tama's forest products. So please stay with us.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American, and that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's unique store in Lower Manhattan is home to perhaps the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan, plus the rarest natural sharpening stones and exquisitely designed tableware. They also host special events such as knife sharpening demonstrations and parties with New York's most famous chefs and restaurateurs. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the implicit and elegance of Japanese culture to your table, be it in your home or in the finest restaurant. For more information, visit korin.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats, broadcasting live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, and my guest today is Tama Matsuoka Wong, who is a former corporate attorney and now a forager for top chefs in New York City, and author, speaker to advocate sourcing, rediscovering, and recreating the best in white food locally and sustainably harvested. So who are your chef clients for your foraged plants?
Well, of course, still Eddie LaRue at Restaurant Danielle, also Café Ballou and Bar Pléiade, Agurn, which is Klaus Meyer's new place.
That's the Nordic cuisine.
Yes. Right. And the Food Hall as well.
Mm-hmm.
Gramercy Tavern and Untitled. Semilla in Brooklyn. Roberta's in Blanca. But also some non-chefs. Oh, so Gunter Seeger is new.
Okay. That's amazing. Like a whole top kitchen in the whole city.
But also some non-national Fresh Direct. Fresh Direct is a really big proponent of local and sustainable. They've come out like several times, and they're just so supportive for small producers like myself to help get our stuff out in front of people.
Right.
And also a Brooklyn CSA called Next Door Organics.
Okay.
So I think there's some things that I supply to some chefs that, and or drinks that I wouldn't supply to them. So you have to think about which things are easier for a retail client versus kitchen.
Yeah, I was going to ask because, how do you decide what to pick for this chef and that chef?
Okay. one thing I would say is I don't really take on, I'm still very small and growing organically. So I really have to cannot take on that many, especially the way that I do things. So I'm really small and we do our own delivering. So that means I can only like maximum 20, maybe at the most, clients, right? If I want to really keep the quality high and keep a relationship, then I have to focus first and then slowly. And I wanted to get the quality.
That reminds me when I went to Kyoto, like, top farmers in Kyoto, the top kaiseki restaurants, they fight for the farmer because.
Really?
Yeah, the supply, they only have like 20.
Right. No, because if you really want to take that much care, and it's also very customized.
Right.
So I know that certain people like this. So going back to your question about how do I pick things, it's if you have a relationship, you start to get to know about their particular cuisine. And then a lot of times sometimes it takes a year to actually know which things they like. So it takes a lot of energy and time. And then once you start to know, or if they're looking for something, then if I see that, I'm like, okay, I think that thing. So it's kind of a combination of maybe they're looking for something, and then maybe I know what there is, and it's really a creative process, which is really, really great.
Right. It's totally rewarding. Customized per client.
It's very customized.
Right. And how do your client chef deal with an erratic supply from the nature? Right?
I try to make it as less erratic as possible. And again, it depends on the client. So, one thing that I think all chefs are doing now is they can always pickle and caper things to extend a season of something that's only got a really short.
Right.
So we talked about the knotweed.
Mm-hmm.
So pickling the knotweed is a really easy way to preserve that and keep that tart, great flavor for much longer than the few weeks it's in season. For me, I also have a kind of south to north run. So we're starting like 2 hours south of us, so it extends the season a little bit longer than it would than normally.
Right.
And then, you know, like I said, it's sort of chasing nature. So, I guess I'd say if I know that someone has put something on a named on a menu, we will do everything we can to make sure they can get that for at least, you know, the time that they would normally have something on a menu.
Right. I mean, I just remembered, you know, the at Samir is the chef, Jose Ramirez.
Yeah, Jose, yes.
Last summer, okay. I think he showed me, I happened to visit the restaurant, and he showed me, this is knotweed. And I just remembered it. He was so proud. And it only lasts a couple of weeks. Yes. And he was, I think that shortage of supply even makes it even precious.
Okay.
Right?
Okay, good.
Seasonality is not 3 months, but 3 weeks. So that's very precious.
He's very, very supportive of like small, you know, producers. And they're vegetable forward or whatever it's restaurant. Mm-hmm. And so they're always looking for new vegetable plant
type things.
Right,
beautiful courses of, if you go probably next week, there's entire different kind of menu. So, right. So how do you distinguish what is edible from not edible in your forest? Because they keep finding new things.
Okay. Right? So first of all, back to my lawyer's hat back on. So, you know, I'm never going to bring something that hasn't been documented somewhere in human history as being consumed by humans. The part and, you know, whatever, the species. Mm. But you can tell from around the world because everyone uses the same Latin. Mm. So if you know the Latin species name and someone else in another country is using it, you know it's the same plant.
Right. So you can prove it's edible or not.
Yes.
Right. Okay. And so, you know, like your chefs may know certain plants, but you bring in so many new things, right? So do you supply plants with the recipes to play with or just the flavor profile?
Well, most of the time they don't want, you know, a chef doesn't want a recipe, right? Because they want to play with themselves. But it can also be like, well, definitely I might say raw or cooked, right? Because some things are not really that digestible raw. It's better cooked. So, but I wouldn't go so far in detail as to give a recipe.
Okay, yeah. Right. So that's the whole point, too. It's like a creative canvas.
Yes.
Okay. And what's the big hit lately? Is any popular plants among chefs lately?
Well, right now, since we're in season, everybody's looking for berries, right? So there's wine berries, which are invasive. They actually are from Japan.
Okay. We are really crazy.
Yeah. Very strong plants.
Right.
But again, you know, what I'd say for this year is that the weather has been really difficult. So it's been very dry. And then we only just got rain yesterday. So people are out this morning or now as we're speaking, getting them. And they said, oh, it's really not as good as last year. But we also have, I have a new property that I purchased on a farm loan. And we're having a very good blueberry season there. Which is, there's like two kinds of blueberries and three kinds of huckleberries, which you wouldn't even know that are local.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Right, because...
And they don't mind dry at all.
Oh, wow. So maybe the flavor is concentrated compared to regular.
Yes,
right?
I think so.
Right, it's not like a plant, huge packaged ones.
Yeah.
Right, wow. So maybe you could give us an example of a dish that was cooked with your products.
Oh, well, I brought you something. I can talk about that.
Yeah,
is that
sure.
What you mean? Okay, so this is I made myself from four ingredients. It's a recipe in forged flavor.
Lucky me today.
So it's using anise hyssop, which I think is a really easy way for people to start because it's something that you can actually, it's indigenous. It's native originally in the wild, but now they've propagated in nurseries.
Mm-hmm.
You can buy seeds and it's very garden worthy.
Right.
It's in the high line.
Oh, wow.
And it attracts tons of pollinators and butterflies.
Right.
So it's also a really good thing for your backyard habitat.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, it tastes great.
Okay.
So this is an anise hyssop gazpacho.
Okay.
It only uses like four ingredients.
Oh, wow.
And actually, it doesn't even require cooking.
Okay.
So it's really easy.
Right.
So you could try it later or whatever. I brought you some.
Okay. Thank you. All right. And then maybe another example by a chef or, you know, like...
Well, most of the time a lot of people are posting things on Instagram.
Okay.
So I have an Ann Mandos and More Instagram and you can see like all the stuff that they're doing and what they're calling it and what they're saying about the flavor.
Okay. Right. I think I found one product that's by Eddie LaRue.
Yes.
It's a porcini mushroom and I think a fluke, roasted fluke with the pine needles.
All right. Yes.
So that kind of thing, the pine needles, I would think of it.
I know.
That's the French restaurant. Okay. So so if you suggest that we start maybe consuming no other plants or weeds, so what would you suggest as a starting point for us, like general consumers, like maybe going to the Central Park or?
No. So first of all, it's illegal to forage in Central Park. Mm. It's just illegal, and a lot of state park places are illegal because they can't have tons of people running around taking things.
Right.
But also because if you talk to the Parks Department, they'll tell you that a lot of the places have a history of it's heavy industry.
Mm.
And so there's a lot of heavy metals and toxic substances
right.
in the soil. So if you just go around, and a lot of actually wild plants, it's good because they take up a lot of those metals, but it's not good for you to consume it then. I would recommend in your own backyard or in your friendly weekend retreat neighbor's backyard, or have a little container garden that you have. You know, if you're trying to plant tomatoes on your
fire escape.
Yeah,
I'm illegal.
Yeah, so then you see some, before you think of taking the weeds out of them, just take a second look and be like, wait, maybe that's something even better. Somebody sent me something from Harlem. They sent me a picture. On our website, we do have a plant ID forum.
Mm-hmm.
It's monitored actually by one of the best field botanists this side of the Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
His name is Carl Anderson. And so if you post a photo, he'll just tell you what it is.
Really?
He may say, like, I can't see your photo, it's blurry, or you have to show the whole plant.
Mm-hmm.
But if you can give a good photo, he can tell you what it is.
Really?
So someone from Harlem posted a picture of their tomato plant and a container died and something else came up.
Okay.
And it turned out that it's one of the top 10 good things.
Mm-hmm.
It was a wild cress.
Right. Can I put the link on the show page?
Sure. It's just meadowsandmore.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, sure. All right. So. And let's see. I think you have workshops that we can participate.
Oh, yeah. So if people, I haven't tried this. I mean, I haven't really done this before for the public. Again, mostly because I'm kind of flat out just trying to keep my business going.
Mm.
But I am doing a workshop for Claus Meyer's new his organization. He's moved now from Copenhagen to New York.
Mm-hmm.
And
Claus Meyer is the co-founder of Noma.
Yes,
right?
And he's sort of a food entrepreneur. He's had all these books and TV shows.
Right. And he just opened a food court in Grand Central Station.
But he also tries to make the thing more than just looking at it as a business. So he actually opened a culinary school, and I think the one of the worst sections in Brooklyn, to help the community kind of reengage themselves and make their own food.
Mm.
So of course, a huge amount of the concept behind what they're doing is getting back to the environment and real food and the people, being good for them, and reinvigorating the community also. So I decided to do these series of workshops. I didn't want it to just be like, I mean, I'm sure that in your local place, you can go around and find somebody who'll take you around and point out 100 edible plants, which is, you know, interesting. But I want it to be something different and more around this concept of stewardship that we were talking about and about the landscape and what is actually happening in the landscape, and at the same time eating amazing food. So we're doing this series of workshops. Two of them will be in different places. The first, and it goes around the menu at Agern, which is their fine dining restaurant in Grand Central.
Mm-hmm.
The first will be land, and then sea, then field and forest.
Wow.
And so each will be different. And we'll talk about those landscapes, what's happening there. And the idea would have you come away with that experience, looking at it differently than you ever did before.
Mm.
And I think the reason that they wanted to do this was because, you know, you go to a restaurant and you eat and it's fine. You have this meal and then you go home and it's like on to the next place, right? So they want it to be something more like that. Where are we getting this? It's more than we can just tell you in a 5-second blurb, like this is blah, blah, blah from blah, blah, blah farm or something.
Right.
But here you can actually go see the stuff, learn about it, see why it's important, and taste it and we'll give you some recipes too.
Interesting.
So that, yeah. So wow. I'm very excited. I haven't done this
cool.
before.
All right. So we can find information at your website. That's Meadow and More. That's
Meadows and More.
Meadows yes. and More.
But I haven't posted it yet, but I will.
Okay. So maybe next week? Or?
Yes. And then there'll be a contact person for them to contact because it's going to be through their mm-hmm. organization.
Okay. Yeah. So we'll post all the information on the show page.
Okay.
Right. Okay. So, we have a lot more talk, but we're out of time. So,
okay.
thank you for joining us today, Tama.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
So, listeners, if you're interested in Tama's work, again, it's please visit meadowsandmore.com. That's one word, meadowsandmore.com. And if you have any questions or comments about the show, please contact us at heritageradionetwork.org. And you can sign up for our newsletter to get fun updates and event information at the bottom of our homepage. Japan Needs is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes, and the Stitcher podcast. And today's show was made possible by Corinne, and our engineer is David Tatasiore. And thank you for listening. See you next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.